KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. The New Mexico Health Secretary Designate spoke with reporters this week about the rollout of the first approved COVID-19 vaccine. I was on the call and learned that New Mexico will get more than 17,500 doses as part of the first phase of the Pfizer vaccine distribution. Dr. Tracy Collins says frontline healthcare workers will be the first to get the vaccine, followed by staff and residents of long-term care facilities.
The initial shipment of 17,550 doses is being prioritized for frontline healthcare workers in hospital settings, starting with staff that are high or medium risk of exposure to the virus. As New Mexico receives additional shipments in the coming weeks, we will continue to provide vaccine to frontline healthcare workers, as well as staff and residents of nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. The principle here is simple. The first vaccine doses will go to those who are most at risk of exposure to infected people or infectious materials.
Leaders with the state's largest healthcare providers said during a briefing this week that they are excited about the prospect of vaccinations for medical staff who work with COVID-19 patients and other healthcare workers who are at high risk. But they said the vaccinations won't change the way hospitals operate, noting that personal protective equipment and other protocols will remain in place. Dr. Collins says COVID-safe practices like wearing masks and social distancing are critical for everyone, including those who are vaccinated.
Even after getting vaccinated, we need everyone to continue to wear masks and follow COVID-safe practices. In the coming weeks and months, we expect additional vaccines to receive approval and additional shipments to arrive, and we will continue to provide regular updates. For now, though, I hope we can all savor this most promising and uplifting moment. For the past 9 months, the coronavirus has wreaked havoc across our state, around the country, and throughout the world. As I said at the outset today, we begin to turn the tide, protecting ourselves and our communities and moving toward a brighter day. This will take many months and much patience, but we will get there.
Dr. Collins says information is not yet available on future vaccine shipments to New Mexico. Well, as we have been telling you, national distribution of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine is underway. Before that started this week, it was announced that New Mexico would be part of a four-state trial providing important information to the company. With a closer look at the Pfizer vaccine, here's Madison Staten.
New Mexico will receive over 17,000 COVID vaccines from Pfizer in the first round of national distribution. Melissa Martinez, a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of New Mexico, is a member of the state's vaccine advisory group and says healthcare workers and the elderly will be among the first to get vaccinated.
The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, who is the group in the CDC that does this, looked really carefully at this, and they looked at ethical issues like benevolence and equity, and they came up with a framework for prioritizing the vaccines. They decided that in the very front line, people who live in long-term care facilities, people who are in nursing homes and things like that, should be the very, very first people to get the vaccine because they are the most vulnerable to the disease. They also looked at healthcare workers because they want healthcare workers to be available and be able to take care of everybody.
New Mexico Lieutenant Governor Howie Morales also wants teachers to be given priority access to the vaccine in order to reopen schools as quickly as possible.
We do recognize the tremendous sacrifices that our educators will be making as they put themselves in harm's way as we make the transition to in-person learning. We want to do all we can to ensure that there's a safety and well-being of our educators.
New Mexico will be one of four states in Pfizer's distribution trial, along with Texas, Tennessee, and Rhode Island. Martinez says one of the challenges will be getting the vaccine to rural areas.
There are people that are in remote areas and it's hard to get the vaccine to them, especially with the cold chain requirements of some of the vaccines that are going to roll out early, that they have to be kept at very low temperatures, and just transporting them is an issue. I think the other issue that we face, not only in New Mexico, but all over the country, is that people have some hesitancy about vaccines.
The Pew Research Center reports public confidence in the vaccine has grown, with approximately 60% of Americans indicating they would either definitely or probably get the vaccine, a 9% increase from when the same question was asked in September. Walter Isaacson, a journalist who participated in the Pfizer vaccine trial, recently spoke to PBS about his experience.
There's no way that there would have been a safety thing where you could have gotten COVID from it, since it's simply a piece of RNA.
RNA works naturally to help make proteins in the human body. The Pfizer vaccine uses RNA for the generation of spike protein, a protein the CDC has labeled as harmless, in order to build up immunity against COVID. Martinez says that while people might experience some flu-like symptoms upon getting the vaccine, it will not infect them with COVID.
It's the protein on the outside of the virus, and it's only the protein. It's not the whole virus. It can't replicate itself. You will not be able to get COVID from the COVID vaccine. It's physiologically impossible. I would say, though, that people can anticipate that it'll be like the flu shot with side effects with achy body, sore throat, headache, little pain in the arm, little minor side effects like that.
Isaacson says the use of RNA in vaccines will allow the scientific community to fight future viruses more easily.
With these RNA vaccines, it fights this COVID-19. But let's suppose another virus comes along, and it will in the next year or two or 3 years. There's another coronavirus or any type of virus that comes along. This can be easily reprogrammed. All you have to do is get the genetic sequence of the new virus, and a college biology student in a lab in one day can do the reprogramming of this sequence, so you get a new vaccine to fight any new virus that comes along.
As confidence in the COVID vaccine grows, experts say other measures will still be needed. Martinez says social distancing and mask wearing will be vital.
I think it's going to be a long time before the vaccine is fully rolled out and fully does its job. And I think people need to continue to be very, very cautious. It would be terrible to have the vaccine and then still have people getting ill. So all the things, social distancing, good hand washing, covering your mouth when you cough, people should continue to do that.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
For much more on the pandemic, join us tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KRWG-TV for Issues and Answers, COVID-19 in the Borderland. Well, across our region, healthcare workers are very happy to be getting the COVID-19 vaccine. KERA's Hadi Mawakdi reports.
Waiting to receive their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccination on Tuesday, Parkland Hospital healthcare workers were filled with excitement and relief. Up first was Perla Sanchez-Perez, a registered nurse who works in the hospital's COVID unit. Just before she was vaccinated, Sanchez-Perez told the media she hoped the vaccine would help return things to normal.
I'm a first-line responder. I've been working with COVID patients in the ICU for almost 9 months now. And so I see what the disease does to our population, what it does to our community.
Sanchez-Perez's colleague, Tony Chris Naka, said it was a bittersweet moment, and he recalled holding the hands of patients as they died from the coronavirus.
The vaccine protects us, but it will never eliminate those experiences we've had. And I feel so lucky to be experiencing and receiving this vaccine, but I just wish that those patients were able to get it too.
Naka says he's been praying for all of his patients, and he fears he won't be able to stop praying anytime soon because Texas's COVID hospitalization rates have increased. Parkland's leadership says they plan to inoculate 6,000 healthcare workers over the next 11 days. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
Well, that relief in Dallas over the COVID-19 vaccine, no surprise. Of course, Texas and New Mexico are categorized as COVID-19 hotspots. Last week, KRWG News spoke with top medical professionals at hospitals in Las Cruces, Albuquerque, and El Paso to find out how they are responding to the pandemic. The interviews will be featured in a television special, Issues and Answers, COVID-19 in the Borderland, airing tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. Anthony Moreno has a preview.
Last week, the state of New Mexico issued new public health orders that limited non-essential surgeries and implemented crisis care standards for healthcare providers treating COVID-19 patients. In Las Cruces, Memorial Medical Center's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Dolores Gomez, says that the hospital has been experiencing their surge since just before Thanksgiving.
We've been preparing and expecting these surges. Again, just looking at it from the CDC standpoint and listening to most experts that we were expecting this to happen. So we were getting prepared for the worst. We've kind of stabilized in our numbers. We're staying close to about 30 to 40% capacity of COVID patients in the hospital overall. We've had a few days right now where our numbers have been very steady. But we are expecting, since the Thanksgiving holiday did just pass, that we're going to see a second kind of uptick in our numbers because of the concern that people went ahead and gathered during the holiday season.
With new public health orders in effect, hospitals in the state that are close to being full may be forced to ration care. Dr. Gomez shares what that may look like.
In our preparation, we're preparing for that worst case scenario where we may have to ration care, where we look at patients based on a scoring system to say, you know, this person, because of the amount of underlying conditions that they have, the way that they're presenting, how sick they are, we hope not to have to make the difficult choice of saying, we need to make that person comfortable, but we need to preserve either our beds or our equipment for somebody who we know may have a greater survivability. And that's always a difficult thing to do. And I think if our community can think about it, the reason that our governor and our state is stating stay home, do what you can, is so we don't have to make that difficult decision of rationing care when they present to the hospital.
At University of New Mexico Hospital in Albuquerque, Chief Nursing Officer Patty Kelly told us that thanks to collaborations with other hospitals, they have been able to avoid rationing care.
So we are well over capacity now. We're at about 120 to 130%, depending on whether you look at the ICUs or the floors. We have been able to continue to increase our capacity, which has made it a little bit easier for us not to have to have that discussion yet and not to be able to, not to have to worry about telling patients we don't have any place to put them. We work with the other hospitals here in the Albuquerque region to actually move patients between hospitals. Whoever has a bed is taking that patient, and that's allowing us some flexibility to allow all of our hospitals to stay open and still care for the patients in our community.
Last month, the city of El Paso captured national attention due to the dramatic rise in COVID-19-related deaths and hospitalizations. On Friday, health officials reported over 37,300 active cases of COVID-19. Dr. Edward Michelson is chief of emergency medicine at University Medical Center in the city. He shares his thoughts on the surge they experienced.
We had a lot of resources made available to us that might not be available if our surge coincided with that of the other bigger cities in Texas. As we move further into the winter, we see rises in other communities. Those resources may not be available. So it's been a tough time for all of us. A number of our staff have contracted COVID, unfortunately, which sidelines them and makes them unavailable to take care of patients. So I'm looking forward to the vaccine coming as well. So hopefully we can keep our healthcare workers safe.
Last week, the UK began distributing COVID-19 vaccines. Dr. Sarah Watkins is an emergency room physician and toxicologist in El Paso. She also serves as medical director at the West Texas Poison Control Center. We asked her if she had any concerns about the vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna that could be rolled out soon in the U.S. after approval.
The reports that we have right now, they're saying the most common adverse effects are muscle aches, fatigue, joint pains, possibly a fever. And those things happen with most, if not all, vaccines. But they might be a bit worse with this type of vaccine. And so one concern we have in the healthcare community is we need to sort of do a stepwise approach for vaccine administration for our own healthcare workers, because we can't all take a sick day on the same day. But other than that, I will say that the more I read about these mRNA vaccines, actually the more reassured I feel about them. And I personally plan to get it as soon as I'm able to.
And once again, you can learn much more about the pandemic tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. Well, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has reevaluated its death data related to race and ethnicity and has discovered the virus is taking a much heavier toll on African Americans and Latinos than previously understood. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie explains.
This second look has determined that Latinos and Black Americans are dying at much younger ages and at a rate of almost three times that of white Americans. Baylor College of Medicine vaccine scientist Dr. Peter Hotez has followed the pandemic's impact on the Latino population in Texas, and he says we're witnessing an historic decimation of a community.
This is robbing the Hispanic community of a generation of mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters.
This new data underscores a message about vaccines that Hotez has been adamant about sharing far and wide. These at-risk populations need to be as close to the front of the vaccine line as possible. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
For an international perspective, we go south of the border. COVID-19 cases are still on the rise in Mexico City. The government is concerned about hospitals getting saturated with patients, and its new strategy to control spreading the virus involves sanctioning parties. KJZZ's Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
Mexico City's government is trying to convince its citizens to use face masks and stay at home. There are no penalties for not doing so, but gatherings may be subject to fines.
No hagas fiestas. Es temporada decembrina, pero en esta ocasión...
Do not organize parties despite it's December, says Mexico City's mayor, Claudia Sheinbaum. Under new law, neighbors may report large parties to the police. Those who are reluctant to stop their celebrations will be fined as much as the equivalent of $850. Mexico City's government is also ordering street food businesses to only provide to-go service. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
El Paso County has announced a curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m. nightly from December 23rd to the 26th, and again from December 30th to January 4th. Some leaders across Texas would like to issue more restrictions, but that's limited by the governor's order. In depth, here's KERA's Mallory Falk.
Earlier this fall, COVID-19 cases started to climb in El Paso, stretching hospitals thin and leading to a backlog of bodies at the medical examiner's office. County Judge Ricardo Samaniego ordered a temporary shutdown of non-essential businesses. Here he is at a press conference in October.
I'm also very cognizant and respectful of the governor's orders. The hard truth is that the people who are dying are El Pasoans. They are not in Austin.
But the shutdown didn't last very long. State Attorney General Ken Paxton sued to block the order, and an appeals court ruled in his favor, saying local officials can't impose tighter restrictions than what the governor has in place. That night, in a tweet celebrating the ruling, Paxton called Samaniego a tyrant and said, quote, "I will not let rogue political subdivisions try to kill small businesses and holiday gatherings through unlawful executive orders."
Given how the Constitution is structured in Texas, legally speaking, there's not much that municipalities can do if it's the case that the state tells them they can't do it, period.
Brandon Rottinghouse is a political science professor at the University of Houston. He says state leaders have a history of painting local governments as rogue and out of control, and stepping in to help quash local measures, like when Austin passed a paid sick leave ordinance or Laredo banned plastic bags. Often, the conservative state government wants to block more progressive local policies.
If they limit what happens in local government, then they can limit the spread of these progressive values.
Over time, Rodinghouse says, this focus on constraining local control has become more of an ethos and less a response to specific measures. That ethos, it's part of the state's approach to coronavirus.
One of the things that we knew early on, and that what we received instructions on early on from Austin, was that this disaster, this pandemic, and the response to it was going to be directed out of Austin.
Curtis Parrish is county judge in Lubbock, another COVID hotspot. He says he never considered the kinds of restrictions El Paso County tried to impose, but he does wish local officials had more power to respond to the virus as they see fit.
One size doesn't fit all.
There was a window before Abbott's statewide order when county judges and mayors had more authority. Parrish says he was able to take swift, targeted action, like closing nursing homes to visitors when those facilities had major outbreaks.
I would still like that particular ability to come in and see where we're seeing places that are on fire with the virus, be able to go in, target those areas.
At a press conference in Lubbock last month, Governor Abbott said local leaders already have plenty of tools at their disposal to slow the spread of the virus.
Some local officials are not using the tools that are available to them to make sure that they are taking every step they need. So just giving more tools won't mean anything. So here's
Abbott's
point.
Statewide order does allow harder hit regions to take some additional steps. If hospitalizations pass a certain threshold, new restrictions kick in, like scaling back indoor capacity at non-essential businesses from 75% to 50. But many leaders say those rollbacks aren't sufficient. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins spoke with the Texas Standard just after his region met that threshold.
Our hands are tied, and no one believes these new restrictions will be enough. Everyone knows that this in and of itself will not stem the tide.
Still, there's not much he or other county judges can do. When the court blocked El Paso County's shutdown order, the message was clear. Local leaders can't take the pandemic response into their own hands. Brandon Rodinghouse with the University of Houston says these types of legal challenges to local control have a chilling effect on local governments.
In terms of their ordinance making, but also in terms of their decision making from local officials, they're less willing to go out on a limb when trying to fix these problems or trying to address these concerns because they're worried that they're going to get their hands snapped by the statewide officials or by the courts.
It's been happening for years, and even now with lives in the balance, that hasn't changed. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Well, we have every angle of the virus covered this week. COVID-19 has severely tested the U.S. food chain that ensures restaurants and grocery stores across the country have a steady supply of products. In the face of the crisis, researchers at New Mexico State University are working to understand how the supply chain could be made more resilient. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown has our report.
COVID-19 has been a major challenge to America's food supply chain, but a New Mexico researcher says it's proven resilient despite unknowns and panic buying. Initial stay-at-home orders led to stockpiling, empty grocery store shelves, and demand that far exceeded supply. Jay Lillywhite, an ag economist at New Mexico State University, says various laws governing food labeling, packaging, and sizing meant manufacturers and distributors were logistically paralyzed at the outset of the pandemic, which made consumers fearful there wouldn't be enough food.
There is plenty of food there. The system is not broke. It stretched. It had to modify, but it did not break. There's plenty of food out there. Farmers are still farming.
In his department's research into making the supply chain more resilient, Lillywhite says the current agricultural system largely remains efficient and effective, but he adds that long-term effects of the pandemic on the industry are unknown and describes the crisis as a once-in-a-lifetime situation comparable to the Great Depression. The U.S. has two distinct supply chains, one for grocery stores and one for the food service industry. Prior to the pandemic, the system consistently provided a huge variety of products to accommodate individual tastes, from the size and variety of pizzas to hundreds of toilet paper brands. Lillywhite says disruptions caused by the pandemic could not have been anticipated.
I think part of the problem that we had with this pandemic is the size of that shock. You had the supply shock initially, and then you have the demand shock from consumers behaving the way we behaved.
He notes food processing plants turned out to be a major weakness in the supply chain, since many are highly dependent on labor and saw their output disrupted due to high COVID-19 infection rates among workers. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, we've heard a lot in the last half hour about COVID-19. Something you may not have considered, though, it has raised awareness, this virus, of the large number of people in the United States who do not even have basic sick leave through their employment. New Mexico is one of the hardest hit states in this regard. About half of our workers don't have paid sick leave. As we've been telling you, a Las Cruces legislator wants to change that. Angelica Rubio is pushing for required paid sick leave, a bill that she has introduced for the session starting next month. This week, advocates held a virtual rally to support the idea. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
New Mexico legislators, workers, and community organizations gathered in a show of support for a paid sick leave bill that will require employers to give 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours of work. More than a dozen states have already passed legislation to mandate paid sick leave, including both Arizona and California. House District 35 Representative Angelica Rubio, who is sponsoring the bill, spoke about her hopes to pass the legislation in 2021.
This pandemic has unveiled to us so many inequities, particularly when it comes to workers who are on the front lines of this pandemic. And I am very excited to be working on this paid sick leave piece of legislation, not with just the organizations that have been working on this tirelessly for years, but also with the number of members and leaders within CAFE and statewide who have been at the center of being directly impacted by a lot of injustices that are taking shape in many of our workspaces.
49.7% of all workers in New Mexico do not have paid sick time, one of the highest in the nation. State Senator-elect Carrie Hamblin says she recognizes that the cost of sick leave could put a strain on small businesses, but that the additional expense can be seen as an investment.
Now, I know that so many employers want to be able to provide some form of benefits to their employees, especially if they are a small business and can't afford the big benefits packages that corporations and chain stores can. This is helpful in employee retainability and loyalty. Now, when options like paid sick leave are presented, I have to admit that local business owners may be apprehensive, as it presents an extra cost. And it is, but it's small. And I stress that it should be seen as an investment in their business, a way to reduce employee turnover. Keep your doors open because you have healthy employees and your customers know that you are doing your best to keep everyone safe, healthy, and supported.
Abraham Sanchez, an organizer with New Mexico CAFE, offered an English translation of one workforce testimonial, saying that this bill will help those that have limited opportunities.
Maria comes to us from Deming, and she's worked with many of the workers out in the chili and the onion fields. She spoke a lot about how people who often have the lowest wages have the least opportunities. So this is the reason that it's so important for us to be able to really push these things forward for workers in New Mexico.
Stephanie Welch with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty has worked to help draft the bill. She emphasized that paid sick leave can help lower the rate of disease spread and reduce the cost of health care.
No one should have to choose between a paycheck and their health, but half of us who work in New Mexico do face that choice. And that burden falls most on those of us who can afford to go without pay the least, such as people helping to grow, harvest, and serve food to everyone else, as you've heard already today. Most people without access to paid leave work for low wages, and access to paid sick leave differs substantially according to race and ethnicity and gender.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And we will continue to follow developments on that paid sick leave bill from Angelica Rubio as New Mexico's legislative session is scheduled to start next month. Well, now we continue our series on another big issue in the legislative session, proposed legalization of recreational cannabis in New Mexico. The series is from the podcast Growing Forward with Megan Kamrick of New Mexico PBS and Andy Lyman from the New Mexico Political Report. Last week, we heard from two state legislators. Today, two cannabis producers.
Of course, one of the most high-profile producers is Pure Life, and that's because of its CEO, Darren White.
Attention all units, respond to Central and Broadway, reference a large crowd. It's a war on drugs.
Okay, so there's this 1990s video, cops are rolling up in cruisers, they're pulling guns out, no wait, they're pulling out a keyboard, and they're singing. Andy, what is this?
Well, that's Darren White when he was a police officer with the Albuquerque Police Department. My understanding setting this up is that the Albuquerque Police Department put together a band of officers called The Force. And a very hallmark moment of the 1990s is this Just Say No campaign. Just say no!
Say no! So White made a reputation for himself as staunchly against legalization. He would go on to become the state's public safety secretary under then-Governor Gary Johnson.
He eventually resigned from that position, publicly denouncing Johnson's stance on cannabis legalization and decriminalization. White remained in the headlines for several years as he went on to become the Bernalillo County Sheriff, ran for U.S. Senate, and eventually became the head of public safety in Albuquerque under then-Mayor Richard Berry. He faced scrutiny when his wife was involved in a car crash, and White showed up on the scene to take her to the hospital before officers had a chance to speak with her.
He found himself under more scrutiny about 5 years ago when it was revealed the former law enforcement officer with a hard-nosed view on drugs was the head of a medical cannabis producer.
There are still plenty of people who are critical of White, but now he speaks openly about his 180 on cannabis.
For me, I left law enforcement in 2011 and I opened up a security consulting business. While I was doing that, I was confronted by a few friends that I know. They asked me if I would do the security aspect of an application. And I said, sure, I look at it. And also kind of in the same time, Andy, I've been struggling with chronic pain, and I've been on a chronic pain management system for, it's going on 20 years now. I've had back surgery. I've had extensive work done on my knee over the last 30 some years, and I just actually had it replaced. I had a couple of difficult times with it, and I started using a cream that a friend gave me. I was very skeptical of it. I didn't want to do it at first, but you know, the only alternative for somebody like me was opioids. I mean, that's really all there was. And so I tried it and it worked. It helped me a lot. But I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to get a card, and I did. I went and I got a card and I became a patient and I started using it that way.
So obviously, you know, like many, your views have shifted on this. What kind of insights can you share with people that might be a little bit iffy on this whole program?
You know, look, I had a lot of friends over the years that, you know, use cannabis. We all do. It'd be ridiculous to suggest otherwise. I had a responsibility to uphold the law, and I did. And I was always, when I'd heard the whole debate about medical cannabis, I was always very skeptical of that as well. And obviously the eye-opening experience for me was when it worked, and then realizing I was wrong. I was just wrong about it. It really does help a lot of people and their quality of life. You know, it's funny, Andy, you say it, because it's like, nobody gave a damn about the fact that I was prescribed opioids. Nobody cared. I mean, you know, I could have gotten as much as I wanted for as bad as my injuries are. And it's a hell of a lot more dangerous taking a cocktail of these painkillers than it is smoking some weed.
You, as you say, were in law enforcement for a long time. How do you think that our previous harsher drug laws and enforcement of them hurt the community? What did you see in that?
Well, you know, it's Megan. That's interesting because I hate to say this. I'm old enough to when I started in Houston, I was in the middle of that crack war, and it was devastating some of those communities. And being somebody that's been an elected official too, I get it. We overreact to everything we do. But I also know they were plagued with, they saw people were dying, they needed to do something, and they went too far. The thing that we haven't done in this country, and we need to do right now, is we need to start treating people who come into our system, regardless of what it is. There isn't a prison cell, there isn't a jail cell in this country, regardless of what their drug is, that will shape their addiction. We better start coming to an understanding of that. When I hear, you know, I know lawmakers don't like to earmark and do set-asides, but if we do a recreational model, I fully support that we look at using some of that money for treatment options for people, because they come out, some of them, my God, some of them, they never even skip a beat. There's just as much, the drugs are just as plentiful in some of our jails and prisons than they are on the streets. So we need to do a better job. And that's what we didn't do. We just thought we could lock people up and then kick them back out on the streets and go, sure, that'll work, right? No, that's poking hope. That's just like going, well, we hope it works. And then we're all surprised when recidivism rates are 75%, because we put them right back into the same environment, most of the time hooked on the same drugs they were using when they got arrested. But we didn't provide them any way to free themselves from it. And, you know, for my Republican friends, if that makes me sound like, you know, some wild-eyed liberal, fine. But look around you. You know, we made mistakes. We went way too far with some of the sentencing. The hardest part of it was we never have been committed to treatment in this country, ever. We just haven't.
I just had one more question while we were talking. I was curious, like, you guys have storefronts in your company. So let's say we pass legalization. Like, what does that look like then? You have a medical section, or is it all together? Or?
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about that. Do we have different sides? We've talked about it. We have, from the standpoint of being very committed to preserving the medical program, we feel that there is a way that we could either do it on separate sides of the building, whatever it takes, making sure there are set-asides, looking at some of those THC levels. But yeah, we don't see a problem. We've looked at a lot of different scenarios. I think it was Colorado, Megan, that said they actually have it divided. There's a counter for medical and a counter for recreational. And I don't think the bills have specifically said that we had to do that, but we're prepared to do it. I think what everybody in the medical program is committed to is preserving this program and doing whatever it takes to make sure that that happens.
I think it's worth noting that even though Darren White is pretty open about his previous views and why they changed, there's still plenty of people who look at Darren and Pure Life with a pretty cynical lens.
Yeah, I guess it's probably hard for some people to see his view change as anything but money-driven, which probably makes him somewhat of a controversial figure in the cannabis community.
Right, and we can't talk about controversial people without bringing up this guy.
New Mexico may have had an early start in adopting the Lin-Aaron Compassionate Use Act. New Mexico had the opportunity to probably be a leader in this country when it comes to cannabis science, when it comes to cannabis medicine, when it comes to cannabis industry in total.
That's Duke Rodriguez, president and CEO of cannabis producer Ultra Health. Rodriguez is also a former Human Services Secretary of New Mexico.
And I served under Governor Gary Johnson. One of the things that Gary was most known for is he actually advocated before Colorado adopted legalization that New Mexico should consider it. I think if had Gary been successful, today you would see New Mexico being far more the powerhouse in the Southwest, probably benefiting the experience you saw happened in Denver and Colorado in general, and probably surpassing Arizona in cannabis. But we dropped the ball again, and so we kind of lagged.
We definitely heard Duke's name a lot while doing interviews for this podcast.
Yeah, he's really made a name for himself in the industry here in New Mexico. There's a long list of court cases that Ultra Health filed against the state in the past several years, but a lot of those cases resulted in some big changes to the state's medical cannabis program. One notable change was a big increase in how many plants producers can have at any given time.
So how many are they allowed to have now?
The state allows producers to have up to 1,750 plants. There are some specifics about mature plants versus seedlings, but for simplicity's sake, it's 1,750. But up until last year, that number was 450, and that change came after a judge's ruling in response to a petition filed by UltraHealth. And actually, Rodriguez said even that new plant cap for producers is not enough.
I think plant caps and the attempt to allocate plants is an archaic system that most states have walked away from. There is no plant count in Arizona. There is no plant count in Nevada. There is no plant count in Oklahoma. There essentially is no plant count in Colorado. So for all surrounding states, and probably most of the country that have medical systems or adult use programs, there is no such thing as a plant cap. The plant cap in New Mexico is a item of the past, primarily tied to the Susana Martinez administration of believing that this was illicit drug dealing somehow become legal. Remember, we had a former governor in New Mexico who campaigned on the belief that she would eliminate the medical cannabis program. So it's steeped very deeply within even the current operators within the Department of Health. They're former Tina's appointees. So it's hard to kind of break that historical bond to believing that there's some value, some sort of harm reduction by keeping a plant cap. But if you look at logically other states, plant caps don't exist. We allow a certain level of capitalism. If you have the resources to build a bigger greenhouse than UltraHealth, we don't object to it. We don't think that small producers should be limited to their hopes and dreams. We don't think large producers, everyone should compete with whatever the investment they want to make in this industry. So a plant cap does nothing else than try to level the playing field. But in fact, what it does, it limits the playing field and it actually costs patients more. So in the end, to us, no plant cap. If you want a plant cap because it makes you feel like you're going to have a limit and no one's going to grow a gazillion plants, which is never going to happen. You're never going to grow more plants than what you can offer to grow and support the market with. Why would you throw resources, water, people, buildings at something that's never going to be sold? There is a natural ceiling. But rather than have bureaucrats determine what that ceiling is, let the marketplace, let the consumer decide what that ceiling should be.
Andy, in a story you wrote earlier this year, you referred to Rodriguez as a perpetual thorn in the side of the Department of Health.
Yeah, he arguably is. There seems to be an ongoing fundamental disagreement between the department and UltraHealth. Here's Dominic Zerlo, the director of the medical cannabis program, explaining the department's reasoning for the current plant cap.
So basically what happened was there had been some controversy over the last several years about there not being enough product for patients. So there not being enough medical cannabis available. And so what ended up happening is there was a lawsuit that occurred. And on the basis of that, what the department had done an emergency regulation, that essentially put the plant limits temporarily at 2,500 plants per producer. Now, that plant count was just done as a stopgap measure. In the meantime, what happened is the department contracted to do a study to see what the needs of patients were with regard to adequate supply. And on the basis of the results of that study, with what producers were growing and what patients needed in order to meet that supply, that adequate supply level, it was determined that having a 1,750 plant count was going to meet those needs, plus allow for the additional growth as the program continues to grow, which the program has continued to grow with regard to patient count. That's really where that 1750 came from. It does also take into account the fact that patients can apply for their own license, for a personal production license, to grow their own medication. And we work a lot with patients who are trying to do that process, who are trying to apply, and those numbers continue to also increase. And so I'm actually very proud of the fact that we've not only been able to increase the plant count, we've been able to offer better services towards patients with regard to their application process, and we've definitely increased how much supply is actually out in the community.
Our series on recreational cannabis comes from the podcast Growing Forward. It is a collaboration between New Mexico PBS and the New Mexico Political Report, thanks to a grant from the New Mexico Local News Fund. Well, moving on now to other news that could have a big effect on New Mexico's economy, the continuing development of the space industry. The nearly one-year-old Space Force graduated its first enlistees last week at Joint Base San Antonio Lackland. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
I need you to be bold. You will help us build this service from the ground up. You will help us define our warfighting culture. You will build the Space Force as the first digital service.
That's General Jay Raymond, the first chief of space operations, addressing the new grads of Space Force Boot Camp. The 7.5-week program used Air Force basic military training as its foundation, but it added a small dose of space-specific curriculum to make it more relevant. The first 7 enlistees and their instructors appeared to grapple with the newness of it all. Tech Sergeant Eric Mistro says the Space Force curriculum is still taking shape, like the culture.
We're kind of building this plane as we fly it, right? So as we get feedback, we're going to slowly change and redesign what that's going to look like.
The U.S. Space Force is supposed to act as the world's space traffic controller, allowing free and open access to that domain. Newly minted Space Force professional Benjamin Navorosky agrees the branch is still building its identity and says that showed in the training material.
It's weird to me that it's so in-depth, and yet at the same time it's so fluid. You know, everything changes like every other week when we go to a Space Force class.
Navorosky says he'd like to specialize in space systems operations, though he said he couldn't yet offer many details about the career field. 19-year-old graduate Amy Biggers tried to offer some clarity.
A lot of things right now use GPS, not just like on our phones, which are also connected to everything. Airplanes, missiles, cameras, everything is connected to those GPS. And those GPSs are connected to the satellites in space, which need to be protected. And that is what Space Force does.
Despite their rapidly changing futures, many of the new Space Force graduates were optimistic about the military branch they would help shape. Gianna Brown is a 20-year-old graduate.
The whole experience has been really surreal, and I'm just really excited to just keep finding out new things and roll with the punches as they come.
The 7 will soon make their way to California's Vandenberg Air Force Base, then later take courses in specific satellite and radar systems. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Environmental news now, and New Mexico, with some of the worst oil and gas pollution in the United States, is preparing to address the issue by approving new rules next year. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown has our report.
Environmentalists in New Mexico celebrated progress made during the Obama administration to stop pollution from oil and gas. But President Donald Trump gutted those rules, and conservationists say that's why the state needs its own robust safeguards. Camilla Feibelman with the Sierra Club Rio Grande chapter is hopeful the incoming Biden administration will restore rules to reduce methane waste and pollution by 65% by 2025 from 2012 levels.
Right now, a quarter of the global warming that we're experiencing is caused by methane emissions. And when this stuff is leaked or vented or flared, royalties don't come in to the federal government and to the state government.
New Mexico oil and gas regulators will begin meetings next month to codify new regulations on methane and natural gas emissions and take testimony. Feibelman encourages residents to comment on the proposed draft ahead of January 4th or attend the virtual meeting that day. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has said she wants New Mexico to be the nation's leader on rules governing methane and ozone, even as state tax revenues generated by the industry traditionally have funded up to 40% of the state budget. Nathalie Eddy, a field worker for Earthworks, says right now there isn't enough on-the-ground oversight.
There are about 11 inspectors in New Mexico, and there are 57,000 plus sites. So New Mexico regulators are sorely outnumbered and limited in what they can do.
According to John Goldstein with the Environmental Defense Fund, more than 1 million tons of methane are released from oil and gas sites in New Mexico each year, valued at $271 million.
If the state were capturing that and putting it to good use, that would be about $43 million a year, every year in revenue, additional revenue to the state budget.
The American Lung Association's State of the Air 2020 report gave failing grades for ozone pollution to New Mexico's Eddy, Lee, and San Juan counties. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Commentary now, and New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall is leaving Congress with deep criticism for the Senate. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Ruppel.
Tom Udall entered the U.S. Senate in 2009 as an idealist with big plans to make dramatic changes. He'll leave 12 years later as a realist, or, as he put it in his farewell address, a troubled optimist. The Senate is broken. It's not working for the American people, Udall said. We're becoming better and better warriors. We're good at landing a punch, at exposing hypocrisy and riling each other up. But we aren't fostering our better angels. The speech came days before Senate leader Mitch McConnell attempted to squelch bipartisan efforts to pass a COVID-19 relief package before the holiday break. Udall replaced Senate icon Pete Domenici when he moved from the House to the Senate. But he looked to another former senator from New Mexico, Clinton Anderson, for inspiration. In the 1950s, Anderson argued that each new Congress brings with it a new Senate that can change the rules with a simple majority vote. Udall joined with Senators Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Tom Harkin of Iowa in attempting to push through a rule change at the start of the 112th Congress in 2011, ending the filibuster rule, which requires a supermajority of 60 votes for legislation to pass. We have the power to change the Senate from being a graveyard for good ideas to an institution that can respond effectively to the challenges facing our nation, he said at the time. To his credit, Udall maintained his support for what he called the constitutional option throughout his time in the Senate, whether his party was in the majority or minority. But there was never enough support to force a change. I suspect that's because other members of the Senate aren't as optimistic as he is. Udall looks at the filibuster and sees all the great bills that were never passed. Others see all the horrible bills that were never passed. And, during the first 2 years of the Trump administration, when Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, that was a frightening list. Unfortunately, that outlook precludes bold solutions and suggests that the best we can hope for from Congress is that they don't make things worse. Udall is right when he argues that the filibuster rule is being exercised in ways that were never envisioned by the founders, and that it has not produced compromise. Only paralysis. The Senate has become an exercise in raw political power, where a person's word has no value, and there's no expectation of or basis for trust. I fear that if the filibuster is simply removed, the minority party will be excluded from the process, and there'll be even less collaboration and compromise than there is now. What's really needed is a restoration of trust and a rebuilding of mutual respect. I'm not sure that can be accomplished with a rule change. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
And of course, you can always check out Walt Rubel's columns anytime. You can listen to them or read them in the local viewpoint section at krwg.org. Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Well, that's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Before we go, a couple of program notes. Of course, it is time for holiday celebrating. Well, at least celebrating to some extent. A little different in 2020. We will still hopefully all have a little rest and relaxation. And for those of you who have those lights up, you know, I was kind of on the fence, but I gave in and I trying to share a little holiday cheer. In that vein, we actually will not be with you the next 2 weeks. We're going to have some holiday specials for you, and we'll be back in the new year, 2021. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.